KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From 94.9 KUOW, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Pope Francis caused quite a stir yesterday when he spent 80 minutes in a free-flowing news conference with reporters who were with him on the papal jet from South America to Italy. Coming up, we're going to talk with two Catholic theologians about what the Pope had to say. Imagine this. You are wrongfully convicted of a violent crime and sent to prison. After many years, you're finally exonerated based on DNA evidence and you're released. When you get out, the state of Washington gives you zero compensation for the time you spent incarcerated. That used to be a probable scenario, but not anymore due to a new law that went into effect this past Sunday. People wrongfully convicted of crimes are now allowed to file claims for damages against the state. If successful, they could receive $50,000 for every year in prison and $25,000 for every year on parole. Alan Northrup was convicted of rape, burglary, and kidnapping in 1993. With the help of the Innocence Project Northwest, Northrup was exonerated and released in 2010. I talked to him earlier today and asked him what led up to his conviction.
Well, in a nutshell, a composite sketch was drawn up, and it was pinned up in neighboring small towns, you know, around Woodland where I live. And supposedly there was phone calls that came in saying the composite sketch looked like me, and I thought that was pretty sketchy anyway, and it turned out to be just that, but and that's how everything started. And they just, the detectives involved and whoever else behind closed doors with them, they came after me hammer and nail. I mean, this, they wouldn't back off. And me, just believing in the system, I thought, well, you know, they're going to figure it out. They're going to leave me alone, you know, but that never happened. And it ended up going to trial, and I ended up getting convicted.
How long were you in prison before you hooked up with the Innocence Project?
I was in for 17 years, and finally, I was 2 years short of my early release date. It took probably, well, just with the DNA itself, took 6 years. And then it took 3 years prior to that just to get a court order approved.
How did you hear about the Innocence Project to help you do all this?
When I was doing time at McNeil Island, I had a cellie that got me hip to him. And I actually heard of him back in the early 90s. I forgot all about him, you know, and they were basically my last hope. I had wrote to other Innocence Projects all over the United States, and I never got no hits off them. And then the University of Washington in Seattle Law School, they took it. And they were my last hope.
So 17 years in prison?
Yeah, 17 years.
Wow, that's quite a long time. When were you released? What year was that?
I actually got out under provisions April 21st, 2010.
Did you get any kind of resources or compensation at that time from the state?
No.
Nothing?
No, nothing.
What, they just open the prison door and say, bye, sorry?
That's pretty much it. I never even got an apology. That wasn't even in the mix at all.
They don't apologize?
No.
When you got out of prison, you were also hit with a huge child support bill, weren't you?
Yeah. $111,000 worth.
Is that still outstanding?
The state has squashed their side of it, but the mother still got a nice little lump sum coming to her.
Hmm.
So, yeah.
So will this new wrongful conviction compensation bill help you with that?
Yeah, that's supposed to be what's going to happen, yeah.
So as I understand it, they're talking about $50,000 for every year in prison?
Yeah.
And so yeah. What do you have to do to get that money?
Well, I know I have to claim on it, and whatever's going to go on beyond that, I really don't know. They'll probably go through, you know, the regular procedural politic thing. I'm really not sure.
Hmm. So How you have a job now? How has it been adjusting to life on the outside?
It's been very overwhelming and totally awesomely awestruck. I mean, it's been great. I've had support from my friends and family, and that part of it has just been overwhelmingly awesome. But there's other, you know, struggles. Like when you're in prison, doing the same thing every day, and you don't have to think beyond that realm. So when you get out here, and you got a job, and then all of a sudden you got these bills, and then going in to try to find to just go shopping, doing that. I mean, I was lost, and you know, it made me panic sometimes. You know, I felt really embarrassed, even though nobody around me, you know, knew what was really going on. You know, with me, I just looked like another regular citizen, but.
Yeah,
so I'm still adjusting. It's getting better, but I still get freaked out from time to time, so to speak, you know.
How old were you when you were convicted?
I was 29.
Wow. So that's relatively young.
Yeah. You know, and I had three kids. They were all very young. My oldest being 5 and the other not even 2, and one was just turned 2. So.
Did you have any contact with them when you were incarcerated?
I did the first 4 years I was down, and then, you know, I think, you know, they mean things kind of fade off, and they just, you know, they get into their own thing and get used to me not being around, and that's, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a harsh reality, but that's just the way it is. You know, everybody in prison is going to go through the same thing, you know, and it sucks.
It sounds like this compensation is just a token for what you have missed, what you did miss in those 17 years. But how do you think it might help you?
Just to, you know, get started over again. I mean, heck, I had a shop and I had tools, you know, and I'm into, you know, restoring cars and stuff and helping out other people, too, mechanically, and just have my own place. I mean, you know, have a normal... having a normal life again, you know, like anybody else. You know, that's that simple. I mean, that's, you know, and that's pretty hard for them to understand.
Yeah.
So,
you know, I am wondering how somebody puts a price on a year of a person's life. Is $50,000 enough for each year that you spent wrongfully behind bars?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, there is no price for that. It's just the mental anguish alone, despite everything else, is priceless to the negative. I mean, it's terrible. And that's the, you know, they don't really want to understand that. You know, I mean, I explained it the best I could, you know, but I mean, it's just, you know, I'm just speechless with that. It's just unreal. And just until you experience it.
Do you have any idea how long it's going to take for this money to come through for you?
I don't know. See, that's part. I really don't know.
But well, all we can hope is that it comes through pretty soon, and at least you're working. That seems like a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you know, it kind of makes you guy feel normal again, you know. And I'm working with. But awesome people here, you know. I've known a number of them for quite a few years, and yeah, it's an awesome job, and I like working here. But I don't want to take anything away from, you know, a company I work for. But I sure would like to get, you know, shaking toward to pay more. You know, it's just I'm living paycheck to paycheck. You know, pretty much, kind of a comfortable paycheck to paycheck. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
So this
compensation is really going to help you.
It's going to give me some breathing room, yes.
Alan Northrup was wrongfully convicted of burglary, rape, and kidnapping in 1993. Under the new wrongful conviction compensation law, Northrup is eligible for $50,000 for each of the 17 years he was in prison. The law took effect on Sunday. This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
Sixteen minutes past 9 o'clock. Former President Jimmy Carter is traveling to North Korea, apparently to try to gain the release of a Linwood man who's being held there. More in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Athena Health, helping physicians manage industry change so they can focus on patient care. More about cloud-based EHR and practice management services is at athenahealth.com.
It is cloudy in Seattle this morning, currently 57 degrees. Forecast predicts that those clouds are going to go away, revealing a sunny sky this afternoon and a high today of 80. It's 9:17. I'm Bernard Ouellette. Some analysis of the Pope's recent comments concerning homosexuality in about 15 minutes.
From 94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. Former President Jimmy Carter is going to North Korea. The White House says Carter is going on a personal capacity, but there's a lot of speculation that his trip is on behalf of Kenneth Bay. The Seattle area man's been held for months in a North Korean prison. This weekend, his sister published an op-ed column in the Seattle Times imploring citizens to pressure the U.S. government to help free her brother. Charles Armstrong is a professor of Korean studies and head of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University. He joins me now. Thanks for being with us.
Very nice to be with you.
Kenneth Bay was arrested many months ago. He's being held. Why would President Carter or any other U.S. official be able to gain his release?
Well, this has happened before. In fact, Carter himself went to North Korea in 2010 to win the release of Angeline Gomez. And before that, former President Bill Clinton got the release of two American journalists who were in prison. So unfortunately, North Korea has learned that this is a very effective way of getting high-profile American former officials to come to the country and to deal with situations such as this. It seems very likely that Carter will be going to discuss this, and it's quite possible that he will win Kenneth Bay's release as a result.
What does the North Korean government get from having high-ranking officials come for this sort of thing?
Basically, they get recognition. They show the Americans, in their view, that they are a country to be reckoned with. They get these very prominent Americans to visit Pyongyang, and it's a kind of a strange way of getting some kind of diplomatic contact with the United States, which is one thing that they want.
So they're looking at this as a recognition of the government of North Korea?
Yes, in effect. We don't have any official diplomatic relations with North Korea. As everyone knows, our relations are quite tense and even hostile at times. We've seen some pretty difficult moments in the last few months. And this is a means that the North Koreans have learned over the last several years to get high-profile Americans to come and to meet with their own officials.
As I mentioned in introducing you, Kenneth Bay's sister, Terry Chung, published an op-ed, and she's been talking with national media. And what she's asking is for American citizens who hear her plea to pressure the U.S. government to help her brother. And in that op-ed, she wrote that she had talked to Washington State's congressional delegation and hadn't gotten a lot of what she felt was tangible support. Why would U.S. officials proceed cautiously when it comes to this type of situation?
Well, they don't want to encourage this kind of behavior from North Korea, obviously. They don't want to be seen as giving in to pressure from the North Korean government. But there is a very strong humanitarian interest in getting an American citizen released, especially one who's been convicted and sentenced to 15 years of hard labor. So they're sort of torn between these desires, on the one hand, to not give too much recognition to North Korea, a country that we do not have a good relationship with and does not have a good human rights record, to say the least. But on the other hand, the U.S. government wants to help citizens in a dire need such as this.
We're talking with Charles Armstrong, head of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University. How many other Americans are currently imprisoned? Is Kenneth Bay the only one?
He's the only one as far as we know. There have been rumors that American soldiers taken prisoner during the Korean War have been held all of this time over the last 60-plus years.
Oh, my.
That's never been verified. There are certainly South Korean prisoners of war who remain in prison camps in North Korea now in their 70s or 80s. There have been, as I mentioned, six American citizens detained in the last 5 years. All of them, up till now, up to Mr. Bay, have been released, usually through high-level interventions such as this.
As you mentioned, the relations, the unofficial relations, I guess, because we don't have official relations with North Korea, between the U.S. and North Korea are very strained at this moment in time and have been. How does that estrangement impact either former President Carter's trip or just proceeding on some kind of an exchange of prisoners or a release of prisoners?
Well, we don't have diplomatic relations. In fact, in a technical legal sense, the U.S. is still at war with North Korea. We've just seen the 60th anniversary of the Korean War armistice from 1953, but that agreement didn't end the state of war. It just ceased the hostilities for the time being. So we have never had a peace treaty with North Korea. We've never normalized diplomatic relations with North Korea. North Korea has obviously created a lot of problems for the U.S. and the international community with its nuclear program and military provocations. But if we had more normal relations, it might be possible to have the kinds of channels that would, if not prevent this sort of thing from happening, at least facilitate negotiations to resolve these problems more easily.
What sorts of more normalized channels are you talking about?
Well, diplomatic relations. We have no embassy in Pyongyang that would help American citizens who are there. There have been quite a few Americans actually working with non-governmental organizations in North Korea for humanitarian purposes and so forth. And we don't have anything like that. So if an American gets into trouble in North Korea, the closest authority we have is a Swedish embassy. We don't have any American officials on the ground to get things accomplished.
You mentioned that President Carter has made several trips to North Korea. Former President Clinton went, and I'm thinking about the most recent trip, which was the former NBA basketball player Dennis Rodman, who went and said he wanted to help out Kenneth Bay, and he was going to hang out with his man Kim Jong Un. How easy is it for a U.S. citizen to travel to Pyongyang or to North Korea in general?
It's actually quite easy for Americans to get to North Korea. I've been there myself half a dozen times, but only through official tour channels normally, only if one is invited and usually only in a group. What's very difficult is to get a chance to meet high-level officials. In fact, Dennis Rodman, for better or for worse, is the first American ever to meet the current North Korean leader Kim Jong-un.
For better or for worse, you mentioned he has tweeted about going back. Does something like that set back relations, or is it an icebreaker?
Well, potentially, a visit such as Dennis Rodman's could open the door to some sorts of cultural exchanges or sports exchanges, which could gradually open North Korea up, as we've seen with other countries, with the Soviet Union, for example. It seems to me what North Korea really needs, well, the best thing to ultimately change the very dire situation in North Korea is to get the country to open up, especially contacts with the United States. It's a very isolated society. Its people really don't know what's going on in the outside world. And it's very hard to change North Korea with pressure from outside. We need to try to change North Korea from within through these kinds of openings.
So what you're saying is that Dennis Rodman could help drive that wedge into the Korean closure and at least provide some sense that everybody outside of that country isn't a devil.
Yes, that potentially is what the Rodman visit could do. We'll see.
Back to Kenneth Bay's situation. His family reported that they received some letters from him last week, and it seems that kind of contact is unusual for people who are being held in hard labor prison camps.
Yes, that's certainly true. And the North Korean government had said explicitly in the early stages of this, after Kenneth Bae was imprisoned, that he was not going to be a bargaining chip with the United States. But it seems that, in fact, that is at least in part their intention. And the fact that they're allowing him to contact his relatives in the United States suggests that they do have some idea of releasing him if circumstances allow.
Now, you mentioned that the North Korean government would like the recognition that a high-level U.S. figure bestows on them when someone like Jimmy Carter travels there. What else would they want from the United States to secure the release of Kenneth Bay?
Well, they've never asked for any specific kind of aid or economic assistance. Clearly, they would like to have that. They would like to improve their economic situation, which is pretty dire right now. And they hope that better relations with the U.S. will lead to that outcome. But that would be part of a long process of improving relations with the United States. There are a number of things going on behind the scenes right now. There's a team on the ground in North Korea looking for missing remains of Americans who were in North Korea during the Korean War. So that sort of thing would move the U.S. and North Korea, at least the Pyongyang government thinks, toward an improvement of relations which will help the overall economic situation in North Korea.
How many Americans are missing since the Korean War?
I don't have a figure off the top of my head. There are several thousands of them, certainly, and there have been several missions over the past 20 years to North Korea to recover the remains, and there have been a number of remains that have been returned. This is an on-again, off-again process, but it's really the closest cooperation the two sides have had.
What does the United States need to see from North Korea that would help start normalizing relations for real?
Well, the U.S.'s number one priority is for North Korea to stop and to eventually dismantle its nuclear program, which the U.S. sees as a very direct threat, not only to South Korea and to other countries in the region, such as Japan, but to the United States itself. For North Korea to behave in a more, as the U.S. and many others in the international community would see, in a more normal way to stop its military provocations and to do something to address the very serious human rights issues.
Is there any sense that the new leader, Kim Jong-un, who has been in power not that long and is very young, has different attitudes towards how his country could relate to the West than did his father and grandfather?
Well, there was some hope of that at the beginning when he first came to power a year and a half ago or so. It's really hard to say. He is himself part of this system, which has a long history of very belligerent and difficult relations with the West and with the U.S. in particular. And Kim Jong-un, the current leader, has to show that he is a strong leader, standing up to the United States, which they see as their number one enemy. And one of his priorities now is to demonstrate that North Korea is a nuclear weapon state. And that comes directly to clash with the U.S.'s priority, which is not to have a nuclear North Korea. But beyond that, there has been some indication that Kim Jong-un wants to reform the economy. He's made some statements about agricultural reform, about labor reform. There's certainly a lot that could be done to improve the economic situation in North Korea. He is young. He was educated partly in the West, in Switzerland, and he seems very interested in a different kind of public image than his father and grandfather and bringing some elements of the modern world to his country.
Do you know when President Carter leaves for his trip?
I've heard only that he's leaving very soon. I haven't seen exactly when that is, but I would imagine within the day.
Charles Armstrong, thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Charles Armstrong is a professor of Korean Studies and director for the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University. At this point in time, President Jimmy Carter is said to be leaving soon for North Korea to help secure the release of Kenneth Bae. This is KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman.
It's 9:30. The Pope's recent comments on homosexuality have been getting a lot of attention. But what was he really saying? What did he mean? We'll take that up in a minute.
Join KUOW for the Moth Seattle Story Slam monthly series, featuring true stories told live and judged by audience members. The August Story Slam theme is Wanderlust and takes place Thursday, August 1st at Fremont Abbey Arts Center. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
Next time you look up at the stars, think about this.
Inside you are the remains of a stellar explosion. You are made of stardust. And without the stars, there wouldn't be us.
I'm Guy Raz, the wonders of the universe and the people who still look up every night. Next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
That's tonight at 8 o'clock on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. 57 degrees in Seattle right now, expecting to reach 80 this afternoon once these clouds go away and the sun comes out. Overnight, it'll be cloudy with a low of 58, and tomorrow, Wednesday, partly sunny with a high of 82. 9:32, I'm Bernard Ouellette. The FDA is proposing new standards for the safety of foods imported into the United States. We'll learn more about the proposed changes and what they mean for you in 35 minutes.
From KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. Pope Francis says it's not his business to judge gay priests on the basis of their sexual orientation. In an unprecedented 80-minute news conference, the Pope also told reporters he wanted to expand the role of women in the Catholic Church. Jamie L. Manson joins me now. She writes a weekly column for the National Catholic Reporter. It's called Grace on the Margins. Thanks for being with me.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Pope Francis said, and this is a quote, "If someone is gay and he searches for the Lord and has good will, who am I to judge?" What do you think he meant by that?
Well, it's not clear exactly what he meant, except that he does seem to be reaffirming the Church's teaching that the homosexual orientation is not in and of itself sinful. And he could very easily say that was what he was saying there. The issue has always been in church doctrine, it's not the orientation, it's the act, the homosexual act, that is sinful because it defies natural law.
The Pope was responding to this after being asked a series of questions about a gay cabal in the Vatican, about various scandals involving the possibility of homosexuality on the parts of people working there. And, you know, I know he wanted to address it, and it sounds like every question he was asked, he did answer. But he also answered in a tone, as I understand it, that was different from some of his predecessors.
I think that's true. I think Francis definitely shares the tone of John Paul II, which was very friendly, very affable, engaging, humorous. So definitely there's a change in tone. There seems to be a desire to have the Church be perceived differently than certainly it was perceived under Benedict XVI. But the teachings remain the same, and so far nothing in what he said yesterday in terms of homosexuality suggests that there's going to be a change in doctrine.
Pope also addressed the issue of women in the Catholic Church. He said that he believed that the issue of female priests had been settled by John Paul II, but that he wants what he called a theology of women. Is that a call for expanding the role of women in the Catholic Church? And if so, what would they expand into?
Right. Again, a very ambiguous statement we have there. Women theologians have been doing theology and feminist theology for decades now. It's not something that the hierarchy or the Vatican officials have been interested in reading or engaging mm-hmm. with. This Pope has been critical of feminists. He's called them chauvinists in skirts. That's one of his quotes from before he became Pope about 2 years ago. He said very clearly the door is closed on the issue of the ordination of women. There has been talk about a new sort of diluted form of the diaconate that could possibly be structured so that women could expand their roles. But again, it wouldn't be anything that a deacon, as the Catholic Church knows it today, would be doing. So there still wouldn't be any sacramental work. But perhaps, you know, so they would still wouldn't be able to anoint the sick or marry a couple. So there's some talk of that. There's murmurs about that. So that's the only thing in terms of an expanding role, perhaps a diluted form of the diaconate. But ordination, this Pope has now made it clear, the case is closed.
American nuns were targeted in the past by the Vatican, in the very recent past, for being too outspoken when it comes to the role of women and the Church in general. As I understand it, in the past, Pope Francis has upheld that position. Is that correct?
That's correct. That is correct. He has. He said he does not see any changes, that he was happy with the determinations that the Vatican had made about women religious. And, you know, the issue with women religious was that they were not, according to the Vatican, towing the line or being a strong enough voice in the Church's agenda about abortion, about same-sex marriage, and about the ordination of women. And again, this Pope has been very clear that those positions of the Church are not going to change. And so if they still perceive that women religious are having those opinions, then the crackdown, I think we should expect, will continue.
So in these three things that we've just talked about, all of them are positions that were held by Pope Benedict. We're not seeing a vast change, but what I believe you're saying is that it's a stylistic change.
That's certainly what it seems to be so far. It's a change in tone. It's a change in which the Church is being perceived. And, I think he's being very authentic in his outreach to the people and wanting to be among the people, in loving the people, and most certainly in being a very fierce advocate for the poor. And stylistically, people didn't see that in Benedict XVI. They did see it in John Paul II, but Benedict XVI seems to have had a strong impact in his own style. And so I think that there's, you know, folks are seeing this great embrace of people and this kinder, gentler face of the Church. And so they're hearing an openness in the Church, perhaps, that isn't necessarily there doctrinally.
Well, that's kind of interesting. Is it enough to just sound good without changing the words that you're saying?
That's a great question. Ultimately, it won't be enough. Certainly, and we all have our eyes to the next generation, and the Pope made these statements as he was going home from World Youth Day, which he met with millions of young people. Even in Brazil, the studies show that, you know, Brazilian 20-somethings and 30-somethings really fall in line really in the way in which they do in the U.S., you know, with their opinions on same-sex marriage, which is all but legal, actually, in Brazil. So doctrinally, the next generation still has some significant disagreements with this Pope, too. And eventually, this Pope is going to have to make some substantive decisions. And when that happens, it will be very interesting to watch how people respond.
Do you feel that perhaps he thinks that he needs to wait longer than the 5 months that he's had the job?
I think he does. I mean, obviously, he has a lot on his plate. A lot of this interview he did on the plane had to do with reforming the Vatican Bank, which is a huge undertaking that he has to deal with. And so I think what we've noticed is he's just avoided the hot-button political divisive issues, especially the ones having to do with sexuality. And we'll see. I mean, it's a different strategy from his predecessor. And, well, I mean, it seems to be working because people do seem to be very optimistic about him.
Well, let's just talk strategy a second. I started by talking about this 80-minute press conference, which he had said upon embarking on this trip to Brazil that he didn't give interviews, and then apparently he walked into the back of the plane and stood there. He didn't even sit down,
yeah,
and took everybody's questions, which I don't think I've heard of a pope ever doing anything like this.
Yeah, some of the older Vatican journalists who have been around for decades have said that John Paul II, when he was really at his peak, you know, when he was really healthy and young and still very much had his theatrical ways, you know, because he was an actor when he was younger.
I didn't know that.
That's how he started before he became a priest. That it was very reminiscent of him, and so that was something he would do, you know, and make jokes and with the humor and with, you know, again, the affability. And this Pope has also proven very unpredictable, you know. So at the outset, he said, I don't do interviews, and then he gives an 80-minute interview. So he really keeps the journalists on their toes, and apparently, you know, the Catholics, too. And so there is some excitement about that, you know. So if he's unpredictable that way, what does that mean for other issues? You know, if he says something now, will he say the same thing a year from now? We don't know. So it just adds to the intrigue of this Pope, I think.
Just the last question has to do with the idea of tenure and style. He's more open, he's more affable, he's more unpredictable, but he is, I mean, he mostly lives in the Vatican. He's mostly surrounded with people who are going to insulate the current message, in other words, not let in perhaps so many points of dissension. Isn't that true?
Right. It is very true, absolutely. And he has said that all the people he's met in the Vatican he's liked. Some of them do disagree with him, and he said in this interview that he likes to be disagreed with, so he appreciates that. But it is true, and, you know, he is a fierce advocate for the poor, but some have said, but, you know, bishops are still, you know, no matter what area of the world they live in, they still get a meal every, you know, three meals a day, and they're taken care of, and they're always safe. And so, you know, there is still a very different culture that the hierarchy live in, you know, and so it's one thing to advocate, but then, you know, what about their lifestyle that continues? Also, in terms of message, right before Benedict XVI resigned, you know, they hired someone from Fox News to do their PR. And so someone actually from a member of Opus Dei, a very high-ranking, what they call a supernumerary. And I don't, you know, a question I have asked myself is how much of this is, you know, really this new PR strategy that they have that has been formed by this former member of Fox News, who's an American, by the way. So, yeah, more intrigue.
Jamie Manson is a columnist for the National Catholic Reporter. Joining us now is Father Paul Janowiak. He's an associate professor of liturgical theory at the Jesuit School of Theology at Santa Clara University in California. Good morning, Father Janowiak.
Good morning, Katie. Good to be here.
I'm Marcy, actually, but that's
Marcy,
okay.
Excuse
yes,
me.
That's okay. You just were listening, I believe, to Jamie Manson talk about Pope Francis moving through the world with a different style from his predecessors. She believes he's substantively got the same conservative message and beliefs. Do you agree with that?
I do, in one respect, is that he hasn't proposed any change in major doctrine. I think the most important thing is, how do you come to a deeper understanding of doctrine? And I think most of his teaching since the beginning of his papacy has been done with deeds rather than with written documents. You know, his first encyclical was when he came out on the balcony, and rather than bestowing the apostolic blessing, he asked first to be blessed by the people. And not long after that, washing the feet of these people in the prison, including a Muslim woman, and moving out of the papal apartments and telling bishops that get out of your palaces and get into the streets. So if actions speak louder than words, I think he's shown a face of the church rather than just a finger pointing of the body of Christ. So.
I read someplace that somebody had described this style as radical simplicity. Have you seen that term anywhere?
I have seen that term. In one of the commentators was saying that rather than a rubrical intellectual approach, there's a radical simplicity. I think what that says is where are you going to find what God's up to? And where does God act? And the Catholic tradition has always been the sacramental one, is that God is enfleshed in word and deed in the world, in the incarnate world. And you don't need to be afraid of that. And that's why he told the bishops, you know, before he left and also on the plane, you know, be braver and risk making mistakes. Well, that's a totally different approach because there's going to be mistakes. So that's where I have probably a more hopeful perspective on this, because once you do that, once you enter into dialogue, which is what he kept insisting at that papal mass with 3 million people, when you enter into a dialogue, then there's a conversation, and then new visions arise. So that's the way I'm looking at it.
Jamie Manson talked about how Pope Francis has said that he welcomes healthy dissension in the Vatican. I've never been to the Vatican. I don't know if you have been there, but is there a sort of a force that insulates popes from a lot of pushback from members of the church?
I think that has occurred increasingly over the past decade, and largely due to the isolation of Benedict, due to kind of his intellectual interests and also his failing health, as it was with John Paul also. As he said, there were a lot of people working tirelessly to do their work every day, but people with certain concerns about keeping the status quo have kept him from really engaging the world. I love this quote he had said, you know, when he was talking about the Curia. He said, you know, a single tree falling makes a noise, but a whole forest growing does not. And I thought that was really great. You know, that it's like the people of faith throughout the world, you know, who get up on Sunday, who try to live their faith, who try to be forgiving, who try to be compassionate. And that's what the church's faith is really all about.
We're talking with Father Paul Janowiak, associate professor of liturgical theory at the Jesuit School of Theology at Santa Clara University, I believe formerly of Seattle University, if
right,
I'm not mistaken.
Back and forth, yeah.
Obviously, the Catholic Church is international, and my sense of it is that every continent has its own I mean, there are teachings that are centralized, but their own way of expressing their Catholic beliefs. In other words, this is a pope from South America, not a pope from Italy or Europe. And I wondered when he was appointed, if that's the correct verb, to be pope in March.
Elected.
I'm sorry, he was elected pope. What does that different geographic sensibility mean to the future of the church itself?
Well, I think his perspective as archbishop in his own country has shown, and by his own actions, that the church is the church of the poor. It is the face of the suffering. And that is not something that has been central in Northern Europe and in the United States. And that if this is where the seat of faith is, then you go where people are and what are their issues and what is God saying to them. The other thing is, I think South America has a very rich devotional life, a way in which, veneration of saints and Eucharistic pageants and things like these have all been an expression of deep hunger and needs of God to be close to the people. Just like Francis of Assisi did in many years ago, painting, wanting to see the paintings of Giotto and the Basilica of people from the actual village, is that God comes to be close with us, to be born with us. And I think that devotional aspect of the God of the poor and the God of compassion, the God who goes where the disappeared are, you saw that great reference he made to that, is a different perspective than United States, which has been basically a church of status quo in many ways.
Well, you mentioned the spiritual aspect,
yes.
but South and Central America have also been the launching pad for, or were the launching pad for, liberation theology, a political activism on the parts of both nuns and priests.
Right. And I think that that's precisely, if the locus of revelation is among the disparity, of which he mentioned many times in Brazil, the disparity and the gap between rich and poor, then the church can't ignore this voice. They can't pretend that Christ would be where the powerful and the rich and the isolated make decisions that oppress those who are poor. That's where I think that theology came out of. And there's always that creative tension that's going to happen then, is how political should the church be, and what's the spiritual element of political action? I thought it was truly significant that he actually praised the people out in the streets demonstrating during his time there and said he didn't approve of any violence, but to speak up and speak about the issues is itself a grace and a truth, and I was very moved by that.
You started our conversation by talking about a liturgy liturgical change born of action rather than writing.
I said a theological change.
A theological change born of action rather than somebody issuing a report or a paper or some kind of manifesto. Does a pope have to sort of settle in before he can really make or show his hand, to use a poker expression?
Well, I think, we have to remember that this is just the beginning of a papacy.
Right.
And I guess you could say these first few months have been, as one of my Jesuit colleagues has said, it's kind of an overture of a symphony, or the first shapes on a canvas, and that it's a creative tension that's going to bring forth something, I think, beautiful. I think one of the beautiful things that expressed this was when you saw the music and the dancing of young people out there on the beach, I think this is going to be an adjustment for some people who have looked upon the church as, more importantly, imparting an unending truth rather than inviting an open door. I think I had heard during the time of the conclave, one of the statements that he had made in the conclave was, that famous biblical passage, "Behold, I come to the door and knock," of Jesus. It says Jesus is knocking at the door, but he's knocking at the door to get out. and I think that's a beautiful thing.
Well, that's fascinating to me. Among the things that Pope Francis told reporters yesterday, that and we heard Jamie Manson talk about the role of women and gay clergy, but he also talked about divorce.
Yes.
And how divorce, Catholic divorce, was not, as far as I understand, it's not condoned by the Catholic Church. But it seemed that in his statement, he really wanted to address the changing face of marriage and family units.
And his first comment about it was, which reinforces this whole idea of dialogue and meeting people where they are, he said, first of all, it's a time for mercy. You know, mercy first, then legislate. And then, you know, he made this amazing comment, communion must be seen in a larger pastoral context. And one of the big issues in the church has been, you know, if someone was divorced and then remarried outside the church, they couldn't receive the sacraments. And then he says communion must be seen in a larger pastoral context. And what is the role of Eucharist? And what does it call people to? Is this a moment of calling people to deeper reconciliation and forgiveness? I know that's my own experience pastorally with people. You know, divorce is not something that people relish. It's an experience one finds oneself in. And then you ask yourself, so where is God in this? And how does Christ walk with me in this? And where is the Spirit leading me? I know many women and men who are divorced would say they've encountered that spiritual question endlessly.
What do you personally hope for from this Pope?
I personally hope that these initial forays into the fringes of society, as he had suggested, you know, and that getting out and being where the people are is going to yield a horizon of questioning, as Karl Rahner, you know, the great Jesuit theologian in the 20th century said, is that God is about the horizon of human questioning, and that is going to bring new questions and inviting new solutions. And the fact that he takes young people so seriously, as John Paul did, and said, you know, you're not the future of the church, you are the church. And what do people hope for and long for and hunger for? One last thing was, as I was noticing, I just did see a video clip of him in that interview. Like you said, he walked to the back of the plane. I was amazed at the kind of ease with which he bantered back and forth, mm-hmm. you know, laughed and took any and all questions. You know, this is a church with an open door. And whenever you have an open door, you know, unexpected things come through, but we always know that the Holy Spirit comes through. So that's my hope.
Thank you so much for speaking with us this morning.
You're most welcome, Marcy. I appreciate it.
Father Paul Janowiak is an associate professor of liturgical theology at the Jesuit School of Theology at Santa Clara University. This is Weekday.
This is Weekday. I'm Katie Sewell. Joining us now, as he does every Tuesday with a hike that matches the week's weather forecast, is Michael Fagan. He's with West Coast Weather LLC. His blog is Fagan's Weather World, which suggests a good hike to match the weekend weather forecast. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Katie.
So what are we looking at here for this week?
Well, weather-wise, we have some changes going on. Tuesday and Wednesday, there's a trough of low pressure off the coast, and what that does for the city, it's typical low clouds in the morning and then afternoon sun. So for the city for Tuesday and Wednesday, highs in the mid to upper 70s, so our streak of dry weather should continue, which everyone's happy about. For the mountains, we have to watch a chance of some thunder showers, mainly after 3 p.m., so you want to be aware of that situation. Then Thursday and Friday actually looks like some steady rain for the mountains, and some rain for Seattle, so it looks like our streak might end, but the weekend looks good. So we actually have two hikes. The first one is Old Lookout, Norris Peak, which is near Crystal Mountain, and this is certainly a good workout, 5 miles one way, 2,400-foot gain, and you can go just part way up and still get great views of the mountain, Mount Rainier, I should say, and lots of wildflowers. Also, if you get to the top, you get views of Mount Rainier, Mount Adams, Basin Lake. Best day for the views to the top would either be today or Wednesday before 2, or the weekend looks really good.
But you need to be in pretty good shape to make that hike?
Yeah, to the top. It's, that's 10 miles round trip. And again, nothing in the rule book says you have to go to the top. I clocked it yesterday when we went up there, and at about 2.5 miles one way, wildflowers are out in forest, and you get the view of Mount Rainier. So you can just go halfway and just gauge it. It is a south-facing slope, so you want to get some shade. We have a picture of on the blog of Frank the dog sitting in the shade and enjoying the shade. So the humans could check out the shade, too. Bring plenty of water. It's a dry hike. Now, if someone's, and I should mention, you need a Forest Service pass, and this is map 269S for green trails. Now, if you're looking at something closer in, something that's not getting you to the top of a mountain and a little less rigorous, this other hike's more kid-friendly. And that lake right off of Snoqualmie Pass, it's a 7.5 mile round trip, 1,400-foot gain, so it's a lot less strenuous. And if you're taking a youngster with you, they'll be a little bit happier because, again, it's less of a workout. There'll be a nice lake that they can splash around in, and that's Green Trails Map 207S.
Is it any good for fishing in that lake?
With all the times I've been there, I actually haven't seen people fish there. I've seen people bring a pole. I haven't seen any fish come out, so maybe you can get lucky.
So that's Annette Lake near Snoqualmie Pass and also Norris Peak near Crystal Mountain. There are details for both at Michael's blog, hikewashington.net, or you can search for Fagan's Weather World. Thanks again for joining us, Michael.
Talk to you next week.
This is Weekday.
And now, the sound of the day. That is the sound of a book of poems being letterpress printed. It was sent to us by Weekday listener Marina Azaza. Marina says it's the sound of a miraculous happening for her or for any writer. It's the sound of her first book being put together. Congratulations, Marina. Well, maybe you're listening to a letterpress. Maybe you're listening to fish biting on some bait. What do you hear? We'd love for you to record 30 seconds of what you're listening to and send that sound to us along with the story behind the sound. You can email the file to weekday@kuow.org. And please be sure you include sound of the day in the subject line. Well, maybe you're listening to letterpress printing, or maybe you are packing for a summer road trip. Not all well-planned road trips turn out the way we want them to. We'd love to hear the lessons that you learned from your very worst road trip. It can be a summer road trip or any time of year. Think of something where you had everything planned out and it just went wrong. It might be the trip you can finally laugh about all these years later. What did you learn? Tell us about it on our feedback line. The phone number is 206-685-2526. What was that road trip? What happened and what did you learn from it? 206-685-2526. You can perhaps hear your story on the air this coming Thursday at 10:20 on Weekday. We want to hear your funny, scary, or thoughtful stories. Thanks for calling 685-2526.
.9 More controversy for a proposed oil terminal at the Port of Vancouver, Washington. KUOW's Lisa Brooks has that in the news in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support from Washington Energy Services.
An immigration overhaul could benefit immigrants and people trying to...
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.